These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Cause you can't starve us out and you can't make us run, cause when them old boys raise on shotguns, we say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. Grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and he's taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land.
buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Thank you. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html page where you have access to three separate chat rooms. One of them to our friends over there at TCT Radio. Go over there and say hi to them and the Awake Radio chat, the old Awake Radio crew. And so with that said, what's on the agenda for today? Ha-ha! Been looking around for some connections in Transformers. Ever since I watched a video with a man called Gerard Morton out there on YouTube, if you get an opportunity to go over and check out his channel, for those of you that don't like somebody with some pretty spicy language, you might want to know ahead of time. He gets a little riled up on occasions. But nonetheless, his work is good. It's impressive. Anyway, one particular video that I saw of Gerard Morton was he took a 2,500-watt generator and connected it into a 50kV transformer and then into a 25kV transformer. And from that point on, he ran the generator and started connecting loads to this. Now, the thing to pay attention to in that particular video is that I listen for that generator to bog down. Every time you put a load on a generator, gasoline generator, diesel generator, even an alternator in your car for that matter, you'll hear that thing bog down. For every light you turn on or whatever, so on, it will actually put more load on there and cause a little bit of more of the lens effect to take place. Anyway, what I was listening for was that generator bogged down, and he hooked not one, but three separate 1,500-watt electric space heaters and a reciprocating saw, and I can't remember what else he had connected to it. But regardless, every time he plugged something in, that generator never bogged down in the least. Essentially, what he was using was the first transformer as a tank, big old storage tank, putting all that energy from that generator into that big tank and then bleeding that down into a small tank. And to get some sort of idea what it is that I'm talking about, how that would actually help, go look at my video called Unsubscribe and watch what's going on in that video and you get some sort of understanding. I give the example of like an Olympic-sized swimming pool pouring energy into an Olympic-sized swimming pool. All the other smaller pools underneath that will remain full as long as there's still some energy in that large water in that large swimming pool. Anyway, I was looking for a resource towards finding some transformers, and this morning I happened to stumble on this video here. Which, I'm going to have to click on that, ain't I? It's Cal's Engineering out there on YouTube. Anyway, he built essentially a homemade transformer using microwave oven transformers and some PVC and a couple microwave capacitors. He built a resonant microwave oven transformer. And you just have to watch the video, but you wouldn't believe the size of arcs that he's actually pulling off of this thing. It's pretty impressive. He said that apparently somebody else must be doing this too, because he said that they say that if you get a resonant transformer from a microwave oven, that you can pull off three times the size of the arcs that you would be off of a normal transformer. He also found out, I guess via his comment section, that he had to run them in parallel, the capacitors in parallel and then in series, before he could actually get it to function the way that he wanted it to. But nonetheless, it's still impressive and gives me a really wide open gate to run with now. I'm going to have to try to put together a few of these things, because if I believe what's possible here, after seeing Gerard Moore and what he did with his transformers, I'm pretty excited about this deal. And it's something that, from my calculations of the deal, it's not going to cost you a whole lot of money to actually do. Once he gets these things put together, then he puts oil inside there. I think he was using paraffin oil. Do you know anything about paraffin oil, Thomas? You there?
You know anything? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Do you know anything about paraffin oil?
Look it up. I know paraffin is just basically a type of wax, but paraffin oil?
Yeah, that's what he's putting inside the transformers, I guess, to help with the capacitors and to actually keep the transformer cooler and that kind of stuff. I knew about people submerging microwave oven transformers in oil for quite some time. It helps them to keep from getting hot for one, but also helps them keep them from breaking over and shorting out. You understand what I'm saying?
Let's start when you look up liquid paraffin, which is basically what the paraffin oil redirects to, you get a drug listing and mineral oil.
Yeah, it's more popular mineral oil. My only concern...
It says in chemistry a mixture of heavier alkanes, so...
I'm just trying to figure out, because I know there's some kind of oils out there you really got to be careful with, like linseed oil. That's not something you want to just have laying around. There's actually been a few unintentional fires because of linseed oil. Are you aware of that?
Cold linseed oil, whenever you let it dry over time in papier-mâché, it takes it from being that kind of fluffy, easy to break, basically crap, you know, like packing peanuts or something.
Yeah.
To like a hard cast resin.
Well, either way, heard some stories about some of that kind of oil there, but this mineral oil, I don't see any problems with it. And I'm probably thinking you could probably use vegetable oil as far as that goes.
I don't know about the vegetable oil, but the mineral oil, there are actual video footage of people taking entire computer systems and setting them down in a fish tank and filling it with mineral oil and then using that to keep thinking about burning speech. Components so fast that it keeps it from burning up.
Ah, well, that's a good deal then. Mineral oil it is. So, anyway, like I said, I'm pretty excited about it because, I'm, number one, I'm in the high voltage. I mean, not like the arcs that he's pulling over there. These could be deadly voltage. He says it actually puts out quite a bit of amperage, at about 2,100 volts. And that's nothing to scoff at, man. And if you're doing like Gerard Morin did, you could use a smaller transformer like that as far as that goes and actually put that into a larger transformer and basically use it like a big giant fuel tank. Is what I see what Gerard's been doing. But, he took that 2,500-watt generator and run it into that 50 kV transformer. And what was impressive about it, like I said, is I kept listening in that video because I was more concerned about to hear how that generator would react every time you hooked another load to it. And that generator didn't bog down in the least. It didn't even flinch. So, between that video and some of the tests that I've done, if you got a huge tank circuit going on, then you can put a lot of energy into that tank circuit. And like in that video I did called Unsubscribe, I was talking about how whenever I was using a little crank-type generator to charge it up, the only resistance I got was at the very initial portion of it when I very first started turning it. But once I got energy flowing into that capacitor, then it got easier and easier to turn as you went. You see what I mean? And so it tells me that with that right setup there, your generator it's not a direct load directly to the generator any longer because you're dumping all that energy into this big tank. And since that tank isn't pressurized, there's no way for that energy to start backing up and bogging that generator down. And then you're pulling your load off down through the smaller transformer so that, all the other generator has to do is just to keep dumping energy into it. As long as that 50 kV transformer never went completely down, a 25 would still be full. You understand what I'm talking about? Yeah? No?
Maybe. No.
Maybe no. So, go watch that video called Unsubscribe, where I showed some people about how that was being turned. I actually did another one, I think it was called 9 Volts. I can't remember. I'll have to look that one back up. But, nonetheless, once that big capacitor bank had energy in it, it didn't even have to be completely full, and all the other smaller loads would come on without no problem whatsoever. So, without any modifications to anything, right now you just bought your efficiency of any generator out there up. If that generator doesn't have to work as hard as it did before under a direct load, then you just brought that efficiency up. Now, if you took that same generator and you ran the AC current, let's say, into a 50 kV transformer, and then you took that energy off of that, stepped it back down a hair, and then ran some inverters off of there, you could charge up a huge battery bank. So, there's also the potential of actually just directly charging your battery bank using the AC generator, and then running your inverters to the transformer from that point on. It's all kinds of different possible combinations that I can see that you could actually use that for. But the whole key is to get that generator to where it doesn't have to work near as hard as it usually does. And that way you would save a lot of fuel. Now, by making that engine a heck of a lot more efficient, and as efficient as physically possible, without doing any modifications whatsoever, I believe this would be the first step right here. To do just like Gerard Morin was doing, and run that energy into a transformer before you start trying to pull it off. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen those transformers out. I know you've seen them, but I mean, have you ever seen one on the ground and seen inside one of those things? Have you? No? No. I guess you haven't. I don't think there's too many people out there who have actually seen the inside. I'd love to see one of these dismantled. I looked out over Google and I can see, like, kind of GIF animations or drawings about what they look like inside, but I really like to get one to inspect real well. And from what I see, what this guy, Cal's Engineering. Huh?
Hey, what search criteria are you using to try to search for that?
For the transformers?
Yeah.
Like cutaway transformer, some people call them pole pigs.
What kind of transformer?
The ones you see on your poles outside, your power company uses. You love to find a good cutaway view and to see exactly what's going on in there. I know, I got a basic idea what's going on. The thing's basically being used as a capacitor and a step-down transformer because the voltage, from what I understand, is 7,000 volts at a high frequency coming into that transformer. Obviously, you can't use that in your house because it burned right through the wiring because the voltage is too high, the frequency is too high, and you have to have a way to step it down so that you can use it down to either 100 amp or 200 amp service or whatever you got, single phase, dual phase, or triple phase, depending on what you're trying to run with it. But
hey,
yeah,
look in your comments here as I can get them open. I keep getting closed. Underneath that video that I sent you, there should be a Wikipedia link. If you want to, you can go ahead and post that in the chat room, too, so they can have a look. That's a bigger, more complex one, too. That's not just the big, round, kind of cylinder-looking ones.
Man, that looks kind of antique-ish there.
Yeah, it does kind of, doesn't it? Because all the copper's made out of.
And that's what's actually in older style. Those would probably be like what you find at one of them power stations. You know, they got like substations everywhere.
Well, that, I think that one is, this picture is from Syria, but this is what the outside looks like. So, while it's in service.
That's pretty impressive. Well, for the average Joe to be able to get a hold of, man, that's a long link. For the average Joe to get a hold of, I think what this guy from Cal's Engineering did is probably going to be the best. Because you can go to your local hardware store and scrapyard, you can get your old microwave ovens and get the transformers out of it and capacitors. And then build your deal. I'm sure you can go get the mineral oil that you need right straight from the grocery store. Of course, you'd have to have a little bit of skills. Not everybody and his brother could do it, but that would probably open up a deal for somebody to start manufacturing something like that.
Or manufacturing the parts that people can't throw together themselves.
Yeah.
200 kilovolt amps.
So,
they have some of that go all the way up to 5,000 kilovolt amps.
That's a lot of power, man. And like I said, if you get a chance to go and check out Gerard Barnes' work and you find the one where he had the two transformers going on, listen close to that doggone generator. It's not bogging down. It's impressive. You know, he's dumping all that energy into that big old tank, which is, you know, essentially a step down transformer, but it's also a capacitor as well. And so it's capable of storing a lot of energy inside there, a lot of pressure. And if that tank isn't filled up and the pressure in that tank isn't built up to the extent that now that energy wants to start backing out and going back down to the generator, then that generator will never have to bog down. It won't have to work hard. And, you know, so I think that's going to be the key. I'd love to get an exact replica of the one that Cal's Engineering did, built, and I want to hook it to an inverter connected to a solar panel and a small battery bank, and just to see how far I can take this thing. Because if what I'm seeing in my mind going on with this thing, if you had that solar panel connected to a battery bank, which is connected to a inverter, and then pumping energy into that, a 5,000 watt inverter pumping energy into that deal right there, you have real time, on demand power as long as the sun's out. You see what I mean?
Right.
So, that's why I'm pretty excited about that whole deal there. Did you just send another link inside there?
Yeah, that's the actual Wikipedia page for the entire thing. So, it tells you all about any type of distribution transformer, whether it be a single phase or triple phase or whatever.
Okay, I'll post that link over there in the chat room as well.
All those images, essentially the links too, those links are inside that article.
The one I'm looking at, the one I'm interested in, is the very top one on the distribution transformer page there. That one that looks like a big giant can.
Yeah, that they're single phase.
Yeah.
If you look the next image down, there's three of those, and it'll bring to convert three phase into three separate single phase step down voltages. They call it a transformer bank.
Well, I know how they send the power out, and I know why they send it out in the higher frequency like they do, so they can get it to travel farther.
You mean the higher voltage?
Yeah, the higher voltage.
Yeah, frequency is still 60 hertz.
Yeah, but it's at a really high voltage, so, you know, it's about 7,000 volts. And being AC current, it can travel out a lot farther.
Right.
So, you know, with that said, I understand the whole concept. What I'd like to see would be the inside of that thing, inside that, what they call a distribution transformer. There's a cutaway view down here.
Yep.
It's a different kind. Anyway, yeah.
Nope. It's not a different kind. It's just a single chunk of it.
Okay.
That's all.
Well, and I'm guessing these are oil filled too, right?
Yeah, the one at the very bottom is a three phase. That's why it's got three separate deals in there. It's a single transformer that handles three phases instead of having to have three separate ones to handle each phase.
So essentially, they're using capacitor technology and transformer technology all in one combined unit in order to be able to not only step some voltage up or down, but to use as a capacitor, as a storage bank. Because what my friend Denny used to say all the time was they always had to have a there's a bar that they put across of those probes. It shorts them out so that the next guy coming by, you know, it doesn't build up a charge on itself or whatever, or, you know, if it had any leftover charge, it's basically like shorting out a capacitor to make sure that, you know, nobody gets killed. Because
any properly made transformer is going to be a capacitor too, because, and it's also an inductance coil too.
Yeah.
Because the amount of surface area that you have in all those copper windings that are inside that transformer, since they're not connected from one set of coils to the other set,
each
side is basically acting as a two-wired capacitor plate.
You know, until you said that, I hadn't really thought that. I hadn't really put that together in my brain. I understand exactly how they work now.
Yeah, if you just tie the two legs together that are connected to the incoming voltage, and tie the two legs together that are going out from the outcoming voltage, you can drop that into a an AC circuit a pulse DC circuit you're wanting to smooth out, and it'll smooth it out.
So that explains a lot. That means that because of the surface area, the primary would be the equivalence of a plate, and the secondary would be the equivalence of a plate. And in all actuality, the transformer core itself and the outer body of the actual transformer itself could be another plate. So there's a lot of surface area up inside there.
Right.
And the oil.
If you just send a voltage, like a DC voltage, through one of those coils, it acts as a resistor, because it's basically just a giant wire-wound resistor. That's all wire-wound resistors are. They're literally a wire going in, wrapping around in a really long coil, and coming out the other end. And because of the incredible length of wire that's compacted in that single coil, per square foot, that material is now producing that much ohm resistance on the current going through it.
Which is knocking down the voltage so that you can get smaller amperage service, right?
I think the resistance actually knocks down the amperage.
Yeah.
Of the voltage. I know that diodes will kill up to a half a volt of voltage for DC current being sent through them. So you send in 5 volts, you get 4.5 volts out. If you put two of them in series, you get 4 volts out. And then, of course, there's higher performance diodes that have a lower voltage drop across them. So,
well, I honestly believe these transformers, along with a few other little tricks that we've been talking about here on Mad Science, is actually going to be the key, because storage is the key. Solar panels by themselves, you know, they won't do the job by themselves as far as running your house unless you got a whole lot of them. But if you got a storage bank in between there where you can save up some, basically it's like a piggy bank. The longer you, bigger your battery bank is, the longer you can run these things on the, you know, like running your house. Like My buddy Justin, he just put up about, I think, 20 solar panels up at his house, and he's got a huge battery bank of deep cycle, and we're actually for like golf carts. They're 6 volts, but they're deep cycle, and he's got them running up to about 48 volts, and he's able to make it through the entire night running his entire house with the system that he's got going on. Plus he's throwing up some wind to supplement the sun. He's also got backup generators that run on diesel, gas, or propane. And so with that said, he's got his own power plant going on. He also got in a fight with the power company, and looks like he won that fight. Now you don't have to pay a light bill. Now, since your average Joe can't afford to be able to do that, I'm going to send a cutaway, send a copy of the cutaway view of this into the chat room as well. Copy link address. Yeah, that's pretty good. Alright, so let's see here. Okay, so it's all on the same page, folks, so you don't have to click on every single link, but just want to send a picture of that in. Alright. You still there, Thomas? Thomas. You must be off again. So, anyway, this little video I got really excited about when I saw it this morning. At first, because he did such a good job on it, on building it, it looked like he bought it from, you know, a factory or something, because he did a really, really excellent job on there. And then I went back through some of his videos and found the one where he was trying to troubleshoot why it wasn't working the way he wanted it to work. And, of course, he got the answer in that video. But then I realized he made it himself, which is pretty impressive, using just microwave oven transformers and capacitors out of microwave ovens. But the key is, go watch this video, see the size of arcs that he's pulling off of this thing. That is some impressive power. Now, if you had a bank of these, and you ran your generator into that, you pull off a ludicrous amount of power. Now, what I'm saying here, and what I'm saying, it's not violating any of the known laws of physics. And technically, you're not going to get out more than you put in, according to the laws of physics. But what I'm seeing here is it looks like a whole lot more than he's putting in, coming out of there. So, you know, you be the judge of that. But one of the things that he does mention in that video, you got to be very, very careful about this, making sure that you're shutting power off whenever you're handling it, and careful to make sure the thing's shorted. There ain't no leftover power in there because of the capacitors. And he's talking about how there's a lot of amperage running through these things. And I'm pretty sure that he's probably running it on 220 at 50 hertz, because I think he's in Australia. So if somebody lives over in Australia and you know that answer, what your voltage coming out of your average wall socket is, post that for me if you can, because it'd be really interesting to know. Just know he had some of them funny looking plugs. We're here in the States, we got the little two-prong plugs, unless we're running the 220, and then we got the funky looking plugs that goes for your 220 appliances. But for the most part, we're running ours at 110 volts, 115, 120 volts at about 60 hertz. So, there you go. Did I lose you, Thomas? They burned it, that boy went AWOL. AWOL, man. Alright, so with that said, and looking at the picture that just posted about how I want to actually build the most efficient internal combustion engine possible, I'm seeing a lot of possibilities where we could literally build a combination motor generator slash power station using just what we could buy right off the store shelves, modifying any two-cycle motor and above out there to run super efficient. You know, there's these things that they call sleeves that they put in for whenever we're rebuilding an engine, and you can hone a cylinder wall out, and you can actually fill these, put these sleeves in there so that you don't have to replace the entire engine block. After a while, when the piston's going up and down, it'll tear up the wall if your oil ain't good and get grit or whatever up in between there, in between your rings with the oil sliding up and down the piston or the cylinder with the piston ring. It'll actually scar the cylinder walls, and then after a while that will allow oil to seep through the rings into the combustion chamber, and your doggone motor will smoke like a freight train. And so in order to keep that from happening, you get your oil changed a lot, and you try to keep it filtered out and make sure that no crud gets built up in your motor. And as long as you got fresh oil in there, and you can keep those cylinder walls from getting scarred up, you won't end up with leaky rings, with oil leaking around the rings. And after a certain period of time running these, and you have to rebuild these, you either have to put larger rings in when you hone it out, or if you get to the point where you've honed it out as much as you possibly can, then you need some sort of way to put a sleeve inside there so that you can still use that same motor block. So these motors could actually be rebuilt quite a bit, you know, unless you have some sort of really catastrophic crack in the motor block itself. Then you can generally rebuild any internal combustion engine out there. But the idea that I'm talking about is actually deliberately honing that cylinder out far enough to where you actually have to put an insulator in between there so that you can have it, not flopping around inside there, if you understand what I'm trying to say. But the key to the design that I'm talking about is to be able to keep all the heat inside the cylinder, and none of that heat being able to, or very little of that heat being able to actually transfer to the block itself. By doing this, you could actually cut back on the amount of fuel necessary in order to be able to run the thing, because the temperatures would be hotter inside there, and so you'd actually want to cut back the fuel anyway in order to reduce the temperature so that it doesn't get too hot in there. And then through the process of the exhaust, you can actually take more heat away from out of the combustion chamber as it's on its exhaust stroke and the heat goes out the pipe. You can actually use a thermal exchanger to basically heat up water or any other liquid that you want to take that heat and transfer it, away from the motor. And also in this little diagram, which I'll go ahead and post this link again into the chat room, is that there's an oil cooler that you can use the same process as well. So the some of the heat would transfer through the piston down into the oil chamber, and you can get rid of that heat using the heat exchanger, which essentially is an oil cooler. And now you're taking heat away from the oil, which is going to make it last longer. The viscosity, it won't break down as fast from temperature. And that's normally where things start going awry, is when that oil breaks down and now it's no longer lubricating those rings like it should be, and that starts to wear on the cylinder walls, which then in turn allows oil to seep up through, or exhaust to seep down into the actual oil chamber itself. So the rings are basically the thin wall that's actually between the combustion chamber and the oil from underneath the piston. Now in a two-cycle motor, You actually got the oil mixed with the fuel, so you don't need oil as much oil underneath the as you would. Two cycle motors run basically off of the just like a diesel engine. The diesel engine has oil in the diesel fuel that helps lubricate the cylinder. So you can run a diesel engine at idle longer than you can a regular gasoline engine, if you understand how that works there. Are you back yet, Thomas?
Yeah, I forgot to unmute myself.
Oh. So anyway,
I didn't bother telling you because I didn't want to interrupt you discussing things, and you don't ever read the text in here to find out whether somebody's in here or not before you jump on them. Well, I just left.
I thought I had the text window open. Oh no, I was on a different page. There we go. Now it's open.
I would say you throw us under the bus, so I figured I'd leave you hanging.
Yeah. I see how that works. All right. So anyway, I'm saying right now, using things that you can buy right directly off the store shelves, at the very least, you can make your generators so much more efficient than what they are right now. Now, at the very best, using a few modifications, you can raise that efficiency up a heck of a lot higher. You can make it so that your oil doesn't get dirty as fast. You can keep that oil cleaner so that the oil doesn't break down, the viscosity of the oil doesn't make... You know, basically, when you heat oil, it gets thinner. The hotter it gets, the thinner it gets. And at some point, it would actually combust. You don't want that. And so if you're trying to protect the cylinder wall so that they don't get scars in them that would break that seal between the rings and the cylinder wall, then oil would be able to, on the downstroke, basically be squirted up into the combustion chamber and then mix with the burn of the fuel on the compression stroke, and basically your engine would start smoking like a freight train. You'd use up a lot of oil. You'd be burning oil is what they call it. That's the shade tree mechanic terminology, man. But anyway, if you keep that heat away from everything that you don't want it on, keep the heat inside the cylinder. Don't allow none of that heat to transfer through to the motor block itself. You should be able to walk up and put your hand on a motor that's been running, or internal combustion engine that's been running for days, and it should be just warm to the touch, if that. If this engine was designed properly to where that heat would be focused right into that cylinder, that's the only place it's going to go, and there's plenty of materials out there that would withstand a lot of temperature. If that heat was focused in the cylinder alone, and then the only escape path would be out the exhaust, you could turn that exhaust pipe into a thermal heat exchanger, which you could turn that, you know, like heat water for your house, or you know, same concept, heat water, run the water through radiator systems, just like you'd see in any passenger car or you know, school bus or something like that, the way that the heating system's working there, that heat could transfer into basically heating your house. And then on the generation portion of the deal, you could use direct drive washing machine motors or the X13s, like to come out of air conditioners and have that engine turning one of those types of generator heads. You could actually build your own and then run that energy off of that direct drive washing machine motor or X13 or any permanent magnet motor that you can find. There's a whole lot of them nowadays because they're making a lot of these pulse DC motors that are really strong, like in the old style washing machines. They used to have a transmission. And there was also a belt in there. So it was a belt-driven transmission that turned. It was able to put out enough torque to actually turn the drum with all your water and your wet clothes inside. That's a lot of weight to move around. And after a while, the agitator working back and forth would wear out, and you know, you'd end up having to replace parts in your washing machine or the whole entire deal because you know, the way it was designed. Well, since they went to the direct drive, which was essentially the pulse DC stator motors, permanent magnet, these things right out of the gate have a lot of torque. There is no transmission in a modern day washing machine. It's just direct drive right off the motor itself, which is able to turn the same amount of weight in that the old ones did. And so with that said, those are ready built generator heads right out of the gate. Don't even have to modify them. You can get dual phase electricity out there, and using bridge rectifiers, 1,000 volt bridge rectifier at I think like 100 amps. I can't remember what the I have to look at them. I got two or three of them, but that will turn it right into DC current for charging batteries if you want to go that route right there. But you could actually just pull that AC current off of that and dump it down into these transformers like Gerard Morin was doing. So what I'm explaining to, or at least trying to make a crude attempt to explain, is we got all the knowledge and all the technology to literally build the most efficient, super efficient internal combustion engine using known technologies already, right off the store shelf. Take the mechanical energy that is produced by the combustion engine, turn a generator head, which could be right off the store shelf from so many different appliances out there right now, air conditioners to washing machines and then some. Take that energy off of that, dump it down into a transformer, and be able to pull real-time voltage off of that without ever putting that motor under load. As far as I'm concerned, it's as simple as all get out. If you modify the engine like the one that I posted into the chat room over there at superchat.html, there's a picture, just a crude picture of what I designed. This would be like a two-stroke engine where the piston is actually the valve. The key to this deal right here is that the only valve you've got would be the equivalence of a check valve for your atomizer input, the fuel input. But the difference between this design and other designs is how you're actually going to ignite that fuel. Excuse me. Oh, I've got to catch my breath. It's how you're actually going to ignite that fuel. Now, your normal combustion engine, unless it's a diesel, uses a spark plug, which requires a coil system to ignite the spark plug. It's got a little gap across there, shoots a little spark, and hits the fumes of gas inside the piston, inside the combustion chamber, and ignites the fuel. The force of that explosion pushes the piston down, and so on. The diesel engine works slightly different, where the only time you use any kind of heat is, or ignition portion of that, is whenever it has glow plugs in there that heats that cylinder up to a certain temperature, that now between the heat from the glow plug and the compression of the air inside the piston, that is what ignites the fuel, the diesel fuel, as it's being sprayed in, atomized into the cylinder. So diesel engines burn and expand, pushing the piston down, whereas an internal combustion engine, gasoline, would basically have an explosion pushing the piston down. then you got valves to release the exhaust, and valves that open up for the intake portion for your fuel. You can actually simplify this motor by doing it like I'm talking about, using the actual piston as one of the valves, and using the injectors as the other valve. So you don't have to have all the different push rods that are opening and closing valves. If you understand what I'm saying, anybody out there who understands mechanics. But so now you got a high voltage input probe on there with insulators away from the deal, so you're not going to walk up there and shock the crud out of you. You could use the equivalence of a Beckett oil burner igniter, just like in an oil burner system. An oil burner furnace basically sends atomized oil into a chamber where then high voltage arc going across the probes inside there ignites that fuel and gets it to burning. Now, some of these are set up in such a manner that once they get to a certain temperature, you don't even no longer need the high voltage anymore. There are some that actually are constant duty that continuously keep an arc going there to keep the temperature inside that chamber at a certain temperature at all times, so that there's no fluctuations in how hot that is inside there, so that oil will burn cleanly. So what I'm seeing here in this picture is that if you took an internal combustion engine, you could literally, all you'd have to do is heat the cylinder up, get the cylinder up to operating temperature using something like a glow plug, all right? And once it's up to operating temperature, you could literally begin to inject atomized water into that cylinder. There would be no necessity to put any mixture into the water whatsoever. It's not needed. Because what's going to occur here is, because of the temperature of that cylinder, the moment you send that atomized water in there, the temperature is going to cause that to flash into steam, which is going to expand 1,600 times its mass, pressing that piston down and then opening the exhaust port and allowing that pressure out for the next stroke up. When the piston goes up again, that compression will produce heat, which in turn will keep that cylinder up to operating temperature, and then the intake portion will allow the next batch of water to come in to repeat the cycle. So essentially, what you'd start off with would be the equivalence of a steam engine, where you're getting steam on demand because of the compression of the piston, the pressurization of the atmosphere inside that cylinder would produce heat, and then any necessary heat from that point on, you could, have the glow plugs, which, after you get it up to operating temperature, there ain't going to be no reason for glow plugs, because in a diesel engine, the only time you use the glow plugs is on the initial start. The rest of the time, it's relying on compression and heat of the engine to keep the burn going. The more you run it, the better it's going to burn. It's going to keep that cylinder temperature up hot enough to where now when you compress that atomized fuel inside there, it's going to self-ignite, and you got a little air mixture going in there. There you go. That's how a diesel engine works. So the other portion of why the high voltage would be good to use is that after it gets to a certain point, when you break that water down, you're going to separate the hydrogen and oxygen. And then using the high voltage, igniting that hydrogen and oxygen. So now you're going to get a stronger burn. Are you with me so far, Thomas?
No.
No. I need to take a breath. So what do you think about what I said?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
Man. Well, that's when you try to mix a mechanical mind with a... And I know you got a mechanical mind because I've seen some of your CNC printer stuff that you put together and all that. So I know this isn't all out of your realm, even though you do a lot of different chemistry and materials and stuff like that. I know you understand mechanics. But... Yeah, I know, man.
And that almost sounds accusatory.
I'm just like trying to give you credit for your intelligence, man. Don't start down the wall being there. Oh, man. So anyway, what I see right here with this picture, with the video that I posted in the link over there, and videos posted prior about direct drive washing machine motors, is that right now we got every single thing we need necessary to literally build the perfect generating system that would be the most super efficient, clean running internal combustion engine in the history of time. Now, I'm putting a call out to researchers. I put a link up in the chat room about a day or two, or possibly a week or so back. Let me find that link and repost it so that people can find it. There it is right there. It is at ShazizRadio.com. It's the plan. Copy. I'm going to copy this. I'm going to paste it over here. Do-do-do-do. This is what I'm trying to do. If you go to www.shazizradio.com/the, looks like a minus sign, plan.html, you'll see the plan. And there is a form to fill out if you're interested in being part of the team to put this plan together. I chose this. This is probably the most simplest of all the alternative energy research out there. Because we already have internal combustion engines that could be modified. And in all reality, we don't have to modify the engine. We could actually use a few tricks to at least, at the very least, make it more efficient. But the best case scenario would be to literally modify an internal combustion engine to do exactly what I explained, keep all the heat in the combustion chamber. So that's the only place you need that heat. You don't need the heat in the block of the engine. There's no reason outside of, maybe cooking your coffee on the road to having that heat go anywhere but inside the cylinder. By doing this, you reduce how much fuel you actually need in order to burn. There's a lot of wasted heat comes out of the engine block itself. And taking that heat out of the combustion chamber into a thermal exchanger, now you have the potential to put that energy somewhere else wherever you want it. Now, right now, your automobile, when you're driving down a road, it's dispersing all that heat out into the atmosphere. There's no other place for it to go. Using some technology already available out there, we could literally take this heat and regulate the temperature to use things like Peltier elements to literally draw off thermal energy and turn it into electrical energy that you could literally turn around and use to run the high voltage portion of the deal and to actually run your gauges, your electric fan inside the deal, which would take it to now where you didn't even have to have an alternator on the car. You wouldn't even have to have a generator on the car. You could lighten the load, so to speak. This engine that I'm talking about here, as opposed to anywhere from 300 to 600 pounds or more, could be made out of plastic. The only thing metal in it would be the push rod, not the push rod, the camshaft, the piston rod, and the cylinder sleeves and the rings. And the top portion of it have a plate and an insulator in between it as well. You could reduce the load of the engine without losing any horsepower. You'd use less fuel. You would utilize the waste heat coming out the exhaust in order to produce electricity that you could in turn run all your gauges and lights and charge batteries up and stuff. In the battery portion of it, the modern day, they call them boost caps, super capacitors, you can actually build a smaller power bank that would do the same job that all the rest of the alternator and the battery did before, and lighten your load up yet even more. There are certain materials out there like carbon fiber that you can literally make this entire car itself such just as strong and so much more light than it was before, and make that efficiency yet even better. There are methods by which you can pull electricity off the heat of the brake rotors whenever you're stopping and starting, and those brake rotors from friction are getting hot. And then we could also, if we wanted to change the braking system, literally make a regenerative braking that would use Lenz's law now as a brake. So where you literally have electrical brakes. Now, for safety purposes, I'd probably have a backup system such as a mechanical brake, that if the electrical brake failed, you'd still be able to stop. But other than that, it is fully possible to do exactly what I'm saying. And on the electrical brake, you could actually make all the separate wheels independent of each other as far as braking going, so that if one of the coil systems in the brake failed, that the other three would still be able to stop the vehicle. So I just explained to you how, if the people in the automotive industry and different industries out there pertaining to any of the subjects I've just talked about really seriously wanted to do it, they could build the perfect car that would be, a combination of a hybrid, gas, electric. You wouldn't even have to use gasoline anymore. You could actually use water. You could make the perfect engine, the perfect car, automobile, that wouldn't even remotely pollute the atmosphere around you, be just as efficient, have just as much, if not more, horsepower, because now the frame, which is just as strong as steel, would literally be just as strong as steel, but lighter weight material. Does that sound crazy to you, Thomas? Thomas, you're always talking about lightweight, strong materials. You was just telling me about some this morning.
What was that?
You was talking about some rod there that you could bop somebody with because it was really strong.
You do a big polyethylene?
Yeah. Is that lighter than steel? You cut out real bad.
It won't handle high temperatures at all.
No, we're not going to use it for high temperature. Would it handle? Could you stand on it?
Ultra high molecular weight?
Yeah.
Depend material. How thick and how long it is. I mean, a board that's only 8 foot long that'll hold you up when you're standing on it, if it were 20 foot long, it might not hold you up.
Yeah, but if it was made like, let's say, a honeycomb core, like in a square boxed in kind of deal, You could use geometry in order to be able to make it like an arch is stronger than a straight line, right?
Right.
So you could take that material, which would be lighter than steel, and basically build a frame of a car out of it.
Right.
See, I've seen cardboard that you could literally stand on, and it wouldn't bend. You know, because of the way that they structured it, it's not like a flat, just a flat piece of cardboard. You've seen sides of cardboard, I'm sure.
If you take a piece of corrugated cardboard, and you took it all apart, there's three pieces of cardboard in most of that. One is on each of the faces, and the third piece is ran in an S pattern through the center.
Yep.
If you take that apart and flatten that all out and stick it back together, it's not going to be anywhere near as strong as it was in the original configuration was, thus why they make corrugated cardboard.
Yeah. But the thing about it is, if you had the right geometric shapes inside, you know, like the S would be the arches, the equivalent of the arches there, both top and bottom, and so that makes it a little bit stronger than just a flat piece of paper that would have been the cardboard. And so you could actually build 2x4s out of cardboard, in theory, you know, if you had the right shapes inside there that would make it it as strong as possible. You see what I'm trying to point out here? It's the difference between some of the bridges out there, suspension bridges, and just a board across the creek. The way that they're designed, the way that they're engineered. There was a show a while back that where they had people were actually taking ice cream sticks and seeing who could build the strongest bridge. And basically, they would build a bridge, and then they'd put a deal with a weight on there and see how much weight that they could actually put on it before that bridge would finally up and fail. And I can't remember what the actual heaviest measurement on there, but there was one particular group on there that actually put a really strong bridge together that held up to a whole lot of weight. And so that's what I was saying about that material you were talking about. Could that material be 3D printed? Could you print that material into...
Theoretically, I haven't seen anyone that's actually done anything with it. The cousins to it, the high-density polyethylene, they're getting away with that, making their own filament using a filament extruder. So I'm assuming that they're able to run it through a 3D printer, too. And there is a company that sells a hybrid high-density polyethylene or polyethylene filament that their main goal was going for something clear.
Yeah.
Like, it's clear, but it was still made out of polyethylene mostly. So, which is, you know, extremely resistant to almost all chemical damage with the exception of really potent... solvents like the stuff that dissolves epoxy that they use in tough job remover, which I think is actually mostly methylene chloride and xylene. And neither of those break it down, they can escape through it. They're able to basically penetrate it to get out of a container made out of it, so you can't use it to contain it. But it won't damage like seals and stuff like that permanently. It just softens them temporarily until it gets through them. I don't remember what they were saying was mixed with the stuff, but the printing temperatures were not that high. So,
well, I know from some of the parts that you printed out there, I was really impressed at the I guess the word would be rigidity or strength that they actually had. Because anytime you think about, you know, 3D printing plastic, I'm thinking, you know, kind of floppy or, you know, flexible.
Floppy, cheap, delaminating.
Yeah.
It goes on and on, but it's all down to how you use your printer and making sure you're using good materials and don't use something that really doesn't work well with thermoforming.
The way that you did it, They were pretty impressive, strong parts.
Mm-hmm. And well, they were a little stiffer too than some of the other materials because they were PLA based, which is not a very temperature resistant material.
Yeah.
It's really hard to work with chemically. I mean, I've found that even stuff that basically does break it down and leaves it smooth after it dries off still causes it to swell up like MDF when it gets wet with water.
Yeah.
So that kind of ruins whatever structure, shape-wise, you have to begin with. So I don't know how it would be with something printed with 100% infill where it's just solid layers of that stuff instead of the honeycomb hollow shape. But unless you're willing to basically do plastic welding and use mechanical means to smooth it. I mean, sanding and polishing, buffing it.
Well, from what I've seen from injection molding process, how plastic plants make like pulleys and stuff like that. The injection mold literally uses a screw that forces the material through and basically crams it in real tight into a mold and allows for, the mold allows cooling.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. And for more advanced machines, they actually have a vacuum drawing on the other direction in order to basically make it so there's no air inside of the mold to resist the plastic flowing into it, especially if it has a lot of detail.
Yeah.
We'll find thin details that run a good distance into the face of the mold. They either have to put sprues that allow the air to be compressed into it or pushed out of the mold, or they just vacuum all the air out of it so that basically whenever they jam that in there, there's nothing to stop from flowing right into those corners, nooks, and crannies.
Yeah. Well,
I want it to be designed, though, so that it has the proper geometry so that it will come out of the mold. Otherwise, it'll get stuck in the mold. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Look at your plastic ice tray after you used it 100 times or so where the edges, the walls are starting to bow out on the inside of the little cavity that the ice is forming in from it swelling consistently each time.
Yeah.
And how hard it gets to pull that ice out time and time after time, the older that that tray gets.
Yeah.
There's your answer right there. You can't have any 90 degree angles that you have to pull across. There has to be a slight bevel to that so that it pops out.
Well, from what I've seen from the injection molding industry, those molds are pretty doggone expensive. I think they start like $50,000 and such.
Oh, yeah, it depends on what you're asking for. Because the more complex the shape is, the more pieces to the mold they have to create in order to make sure there are no 90-degree poles or greater. 90 or greater than 90 degrees.
Yeah.
You know?
But what I was trying to say was they get really creative about how they do these. It's almost amazing to see. It's like a puzzle that comes together.
Yeah, that's what I said. More parts.
Yeah.
You're not just two pieces that you pop apart and the part falls out. You're looking at, 5, 10, 15 pieces that have thick walls with holes going through it, and then they take a pin that matches the size of the hole to run through the two holes where the two faces come together to make sure they're lined up exactly the same every single time.
Yeah.
So.
But either way, using 3D printing, injection molding, and like your CNC mill that you was talking about,
mm-hmm.
you could literally build an entire engine with those three technologies, just like the one I'm talking about.
Right.
And so with that said, that would give you, the computer programming. Once you got the first one done, where you could mass replicate these engines. Started off as a toy first to prove the concept. Use the toy to sell on the market for people to understand how internal combustion engines work, and then turn around and work your way towards making them so that they're large enough to run you know, maybe small generators first. And then from that point on, you work your way up using the fundings from, you know, selling the models on the market to prove the concept. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I posted a link over there at the shazizradio.com superchat.html for the plan HTML. On this page, you'll see basically a little explanation of what I'm looking for, people needed to do this. And I'm not looking for the individual out there that thinks that it can't be done. So there's like a little three-question questionnaire right there of what you believe or whatever. And fill it out honestly. And if you have any questions, there's a form there to pop a question in with your email address. And at the bottom is a explanation of what it is that I'm talking about. And there's also a you know, picture of this engine that we've been explaining. So, as far as I'm concerned, the simplest project in order to prove once and for all free energy, and I know there's going to be those out there that's going to say ain't nothing free about energy, whatever, regardless. At the very least, what you're going to get out of this deal right here, and this is probably something that I would consider going doing a GoFundMe account to build. If I had the right crew with me, and we could put this this process together, and I knew that we were going to do this, I wouldn't be opposed to offering people a copy of this engine once it's all set up for their own personal use or whatever, just to make sure that this got made. What do you think, Thomas?
What are you talking about? Offering them a copy?
Yeah, once it's all printed out.
You talking about people donating to get it done, or are you talking
about folks
who are doing the actual making?
Folks that were willing to invest in the process.
Yeah, you just have to make sure that they're donating enough to cover, you know, materials and whatnot. Otherwise, you'll run yourself into a hole real fast.
Well, that's why I say I need... look... I ain't gonna repeat what I said before, but I couldn't sell a gold tooth to a certain individual. It was funny the first time, though. I don't even know where it came from. But anyway.
Well, hey, you don't have to sell something to someone. You can let something sell itself if it's actually worthwhile.
Well, and I believe this is. And I'd like to get a live stream put together of a bunch of different researchers, and this is the first step to getting those researchers to the table, is to invite them with the plan. Once we get the people who are all interested in doing it, we get a list of names, we can set up a live stream, tell everybody about it, you know, and post it on every one of the researchers' YouTubes. This is what we got going on, this is what we're all going to do together just to prove that this can be done. And from that point on, we should have a working prototype sitting on somebody's table that we can prove what we've been saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm trying, folks. I'm trying to give the world free energy. Give me a little bit of help and we'll get it done. You know, to this point, I ain't never asked anybody for nothing except for their time. But if I can put this together and get these researchers together and have them all on board in agreement that they believe it'll function just like we said, and we actually put the thing together, make it work, then from that point on, when we have something on the table to show you, then you can decide from that point on whether or not to step on board or not. That sound like a good idea? Thomas? Man. Oh. I got to get...
You got to toke up again, man.
I got to get my wingman back.
What wingman?
Somebody who used to help me catch my breath once in a while.
You know, wingman, we at the bar.
I got a lot to say. I got a lot to say, but, you know, I can't say it all in one breath.
But hey, man.
Is somebody in the mad science room trying to get in, or is that you?
I was talking to Muddy earlier, but, I mean, he's been added to the call. He just ain't joining.
Oh, that's stinks.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Maybe he's having technical difficulties.
What's the hassle, man?
Man?
No hassle. All right.
Well,
I don't know where to go from here. I don't sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but I think I got it all figured out now. I've got a plan to build a wooden prototype that would be good for measurements for anybody who could 3D model and print a plastic version of it. If I can not only make it out of wood and make it out of plastic, then I know for a fact that the mainstream engineers and manufacturers could replicate it in a stronger version or whatever. But what I'm saying here is as close to free energy as you're going to get right at this moment, without further research into more exotic materials and more exotic... right now, we're sitting in the year 2017. We should be so much further advanced than what we are right now. That's why I call it mad science. But in my quest to find the best alternative energy device out there, I've run across a lot of scam artists which give the alternative energy community a bad name. I've run across a lot of people who come up with a lot of good ideas but just never seem to be able to take it any farther. I've seen all the different anomalies. I've seen all the different alternative energy devices. I've got a pretty good understanding of which ones will function and which ones won't. And even the ones that won't still have anomalies that are pieces of the puzzle that could literally do what it is that I'm talking about. Of all the alternative energy devices that have come into play since I've been researching this for over 10 years or more, Stan Myers driving around in a dune buggy in 1979, running on water, was probably one of the best ones that I have seen to date. You know, outside of getting more high-tech into plasma technology, this right here is something that would be more apt to be able to be done faster to at least give time for the more exotic machines to be actually built. The internal combustion engine is not new science. The energy like alternators and generators, not new science. The science of what it is that I'm talking about by guiding temperature where you want it to go as opposed to where it wants to go, it's not new science. Everything that I've talked about right here is already proven science. It doesn't defy any of the known laws of physics. And it, at the very least, simply makes an internal combustion engine so super efficient that the average Joe can afford the fuel. And if we take it to the extremes to what Stan Myers did, there ain't no question that everyone could afford to run this machine. You could literally build a cheap, super efficient generator that the average Joe can afford to put fuel in, because it's simply gather up rainwater, creek water, or any water, filter it out, run it through an atomizer, and send it on into the chamber, and use that fuel, and your exhaust is water. So, We could build these en masse that the average Joe would have a plug-and-play generator that they could use anywhere in any weather conditions and be able to either get AC or heat, whichever they needed. Air conditioning or heat. They'd be able to get hot water. Everything that you, all the luxuries of life that you can see right now that have pertaining to electricity and temperature could be resolved with this one project. So how you doing, buddy? What do you think about all that?
I kind of just walked in, kind of towards the middle of all of that. I do understand about having ideas and not being able to go any farther with it. Murphy's Law kind of pushes for that. But I've had a lot of experience with that. I've got a lot of ideas, but trying to be nice to jump in on them.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Murphy's Law kind of just bounces around there. As soon as you got an idea, that's always seems to be when stuff wants to start, you know. But
I'll tell you what, if there's one nation out there that would be willing to manufacture what it is that I'm talking about, I'll go directly to them, even if I have to go to China to have it done.
I like your version of that internal combustion engine. Insulated sidewalls of the piston, keeping the heat. And that goes out the exhaust. It goes through a heat exchanger to grab the heat. Now there, after the combustion expansion, energy has been turned to mechanical. All that's left is the heat, and that's what you're trying to absorb on the way out.
Yeah.
That right there tells me a lot. I like that. And maybe, you know, like a carburetor that actually operates off the fumes, kind of like that one that GM bought that would have got us 200 miles to the gallon. You know, I say sticking all that together would be awesome. Now, I'm pretty sure I can insulate the sidewalls of a piston from getting, most of these engines out here are aluminum. I know for a fact. I've made a few of these wood-burning gasification wood stoves out of the thick venom cans that used to be real hard, and I've melted them suckers. So I mean, throwing something like the combustion of gasoline, I'm pretty sure would melt any aluminum block. It'd have to be like a cast iron or something, or even something like. Doggone, I'm thinking tungsten, but that's not what I... titanium or something that could actually handle the heat, I believe.
Well, I honestly believe that if this is done properly, you can regulate the heat inside that cylinder.
Well, here's the option, I do believe. Now, I know that if you run... you got cooling fins on your aluminum blocks, such as the Briggs and Stratton or so. You can actually encase that and run water across that or another medium and use that as your heat exchanger. It's already set up to exchange heat for air.
Well, imagine if you took copper tubing and you wound it around the cylinder sleeve and you used like the copper tubing as a water jacket, and in between the copper tubing and the actual block of the wall of the block, you used the best heat insulators out there that would keep that heat from being able to transfer to the actual block itself. You see what I'm saying?
That's what I was getting at, but you really don't even need to do all that. Just make a water jacket around the fins to that piston.
Yeah.
And that might cause it to run a little cold. You have to have some heat in there. So, kind of limit the flow of what you got going across it. And, you can regulate that well to where it would actually run good and keep your heat exchanger in the exhaust and collect all that heat.
Yeah.
That's a lot of heat. And the thing is, see, here one time I brought one of my taxi cabs, under the carport into the back, which was pretty much into the backyard. and I was going to flush the radiator. Well, I couldn't get that little bit, that little twisty valve at the bottom of the radiator to come loose. And I couldn't get it to drain. I said, well, I have to drain it through the hose. I didn't want to mess with that bottom hose and then have, you know, have it all pouring on me and stuff like that. The car was still a little warm. So what I did is I took that top clamp to the radiator. I took that loose and I pulled it back. And I said, shoot, we'll just start the car and run it out real quick. And then I put the plugs in, let it rush and do all that. And it didn't seem to work out too good. Well, I said, well, you know what? I put the flush in there and I just let it run through and let it run through and run through. Then I said, well, I don't want to run the engine too hot or something. So I stuck the hose in going into the radiator. And it seemed to come out a little faster than the hose was put in. So I took the hose halfway over the opening for the rest of it. You know what? I thought it would start running cold. It did not run cold. What it did, it heated that water to well above shower temp continuously, as long as that engine was just idling.
Yeah.
The hose on full, and so the water was coming out about as fast as it would go into the hose, and before they had instant on hot water heating, I had instant on, or instant water heating at a rate that would be great for a shower. So, up then, you know, that was a V8, that was a 305, Chevy 305. And I thought that was very interesting, because, you remember before when I said the gas got, you know, I moved into the house and they wanted $500 deposit just to turn the gas on. The only thing the gas did was the hot water heating, and the $500 that deposit was actually what the people before me owed, which means they probably wasn't going to get that back. So, my deal was, I took that wavy piece of metal that went down through the middle of the hot water heater. I lifted it up after taking the blue stack off, and I stuck a 750-watt electric hair dryer down it, and that blew straight down and bounced off the sides. You know what? Water heated up in around 10 minutes, and it was good enough for showers and faucet. Your electric elements in the hot water heating, you're looking at 3,600 watts. What do I need to run 3,600 watts of my electricity for? You know, which I didn't have an electric heater, but I kind of sit there and think that 750 watts would, after 10 minutes of just heating up, I say that's quite a bit of difference just running a hair dryer on low. And that was pretty decent. We all took showers. There were like seven of us. And washed the dishes, washed clothes. But, my goodness, what a savings. We didn't see a dent in our electric bill hardly at all.
Well, that's my point exactly, is that...
The engine would sit there and make the heat, enough to heat up that much water. That's a lot of energy. That's basically a regular hot water heater is looking at 3,600 watts, but this made it almost instant. It would continually make it as fast as you could use it, as fast as it would come out of the hose. That's a lot of energy.
If you go look at my video, Redneck Hot Tub.
But we put it in a radiator and bleed it off with a fan and just waste it. They're talking about global warming. Now, come on, man. Let's just start using that energy.
If you go look at my video, Redneck Hot Tub, and you see that I got the water is out, it's out in outside. It's out in the open air. And yep. It took about 4, maybe 6 hours to get it up to operating temperature when you first turned it on. But once you got it up to operating temperature, it would maintain that temperature. It'd get so hot you couldn't even sit in it. And so,
if you look at your pop maker, you're looking at it, it's 1,500 watts, isn't it?
It's a lot less, than the normal 220, hot water systems in hot tubs.
That's right.
You're running off the equivalents of a coffee pot instead of having to have all that other energy. That's the whole point of all of this right here. At the very least, we could make this so doggone efficient that you would save a large portion of your electric bill.
Those coffee makers are only 600 watts.
Yeah, see, I don't even know what the wattage is on that one. I know it wasn't very much, but I could run that thing 24 hours a day and keep that water hot. I was sitting out, it was snow on the ground, and I was sitting in the hot tub in my shorts.
Commercial coffee pots and restaurants and so forth run anywhere from 12 to 1500 watts, but a residential coffee pot runs anywhere from 600 to 700 watts.
I got to step away for a minute. Can you guys hold the fort?
Sure.
All right, be right back.
Well, he did something for the electric coffee pot, didn't he? Did he import it? Yep. All by myself.
Sorry.
Hey.
I had to step outside and go get my coffee,
Major. Okay, there you go.
And I'm going to sit here and put on the glasses you gave me so I could actually read this stuff. This bad boy. No wattage. Nothing. Well, there we go. Yep, this one's 600 watts. Okay. That makes about four cups of coffee in about 4 minutes.
600 watts, and he's heating a hot tub.
Yeah, that's heating his hot tub.
Now, he said it about 6 hours, so 6 hours would be 3,600 watts, or 3.6 kilowatts.
That's a lot. And you got more than 40, as compared to a hot water heater, you got more than 45 gallons sitting in a hot tub.
Right.
So you're actually doing pretty good, especially if you lay some bubble wrap on top of the water in the hot tub. That makes it very thermal and that doesn't lose a lot of the heat.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I saw his hot tub. He didn't even have the bottom on the insulated.
He didn't even have the bottom insulated?
Yes, sir. So it's fantastic, actually. If you'd insulated the bottom and the sides and the top, like you said, the bubble wrap, he'd probably heat the thing up in 2 or 3 hours. But he was.
So did you fill that thing up while you were there? Did you get to use it?
Well, he took off. He said the water got so hot you couldn't get in.
Oh, man.
You need a thermostat on the thing all the time. But now, if it is, with a thermostat, you would use hardly any energy at all when he was not using it. And then put the bowl right back just where he's sitting, and thank God he had made very, very efficient.
All right, I'm back. How'd that go?
We'd rather see your front.
Oh. So anyway, essentially, we can actually regulate the temperature inside the combustion chamber so that we don't have to worry about it getting too hot and actually breaking down, melting the cylinder sleeve or whatever.
Could put that thing on on that hot tub. You could put that on a timer. 600 watts is going to burn out a timer.
Well, yeah, if you had a thermostat going on, then you could get the water if you wanted it at 160 degrees or whatever. I don't know, whatever the temperature. Body's 98.6, so I wouldn't want to keep it too hot. But
my hot tub, when I had one, I kept it at about 118, 120 degrees, which really truly is about 8 to 10 degrees hotter than most people like.
Yeah.
I really like it. Most people keep the hot tub at about 110 degrees.
But nonetheless, with a thermostat going on that would measure the temperature of the water, you could actually regulate that to where you'd make it even more efficient.
Yes, you could.
Now you took a coffee pot element and you're using less energy to heat the water and being able to do it more efficiently because now you're measuring the temperature of the water and it's turning itself on and off.
Yeah.
No, actually, with part of that and a little bit of insulation around the bottom of the hot tub and at the bottom and the side, and I'm also doing like Scott said, you bubble wrap the top. You only pull the bubble wrap that far enough for you to get in. You can probably use the thing for an hour or two every night, and the whole entire thing, leave it on all the time, and it'll probably run you somewhere between $3 and $3.50 a month to operate.
I'm gonna run a test this summer. I'm gonna actually go out and get a whole bunch of those cans of expanding foam and fill up the whole entire underbelly of that hot tub with expanding foam to insulate it, and then run it again to see how it works.
I'll tell you what she says. Do like Boom Boom did, and my neighbor down on the other side of the block there. They called Ass Plunder. One of them tree trimming places there that trim all the trees away from the power lines.
Yeah.
They have to look for a place to dump all that all them wood chips, and the compost really good. Go down to Starbucks, get you a trash bag full of coffee grounds, bring it, mix it up in there, dig you a little pit, then set the hot tub down inside that. Don't worry about it. It'll be hot as long as you want.
Yes, it will. Rise and pull over to it. Generate a lot of heat. A lot of heat.
Yeah.
There's a guy in Holland. I saw a video on him on YouTube years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago. This guy builds compost piles out of wood chips. I mean, he builds them like 15 feet with plastic piles. Also, as he builds it, he heats his house everywhere.
Cool.
And hey, come spring, you've got compost for your garden.
Hey,
yeah.
Instead of going out and buying a whole bunch of expanding foam containers at like what, $8-$10 a can?
Yeah.
Just go out and go hit some stores up and ask them for the packing supplies and whatnot, and cardboard box nonsense that they've got, and put a wall. Get a piece of wood or cardboard or something, put it over that back opening that's just open to the air there, and fill that thing completely up with the styrofoam peanuts, and then put that wall up on there.
Oh, yeah, people get the styrofoam peanuts away all the time. Well,
that's a good idea.
Work just as well as that expanding foam, man.
But you know, your thing with the amount of land you've got and have a garden off, the wood chips would be a whole lot better idea because they're free and literally to you. And you wind up in the spring with compost for your garden. And then you do it all over again. In the summer, on the pre-trimming, get more trees in.
Cool. See, all these alternative energy ideas, we've already put so much on the table. You know, and I got critics out there, out the eyeball, that, you know, continuously tell me how stupid I am. But we sat here and we explained how to take and custom build or even modify an existing internal combustion engine to the extent where that thing would be so super efficient, there is no such thing as wasted energy on that.
You know, see, this, you mention a lot of times about people calling you stupid. The thing is, we have proven 150 to 300 times that everybody that has ever called you stupid was just downright ignorant. They have no idea what we're talking about.
Well, it's been a long, hard road to try to get to this point to find, you know, I searched up video after video, talked to all types of researchers, tried to find the best, most plausible plan in order to try to bring energy to people around the world. And what I'm seeing right here is probably the easiest way that once and for all could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt energy is free. Now, I'm not even going to argue with the folks that say energy ain't free. I'm not even going to give them that platform. Basically, what I'm saying right here, by shooting for nothing more than super efficiency, I believe we will prove once and for all that energy is indeed free. If you took a look at the internal combustion engine and you actually did the math of an internal combustion engine, measure all the BTUs coming off of it in the form of waste heat, One of the other things that causes an engine to get hot is the vibration of that engine. You actually have to have certain flexible parts, such as your motor mounts, otherwise that thing will rattle your teeth out of your face. So, it's vibrating so much that it's producing heat. It is building up heat from the combustion portion of it, any friction of even the camshaft set down in oil is still picking up heat, because some of that heat's actually transferring from the combustion down to through the camshaft rod down to the cam itself, and it's transferring down there, which is causing friction, which is breaking down that oil in between there and making the parts not last nearly as long. But imagine if you could keep that oil at a regulated temperature down to where you wanted it to be, to keep that oil just warm enough to keep it lubricated, but not ever be able to break down the viscosity. You see what I'm saying? So, we got the technology to literally build the perfect generators. And we can do it with things that we can buy off the store shelves and materials that are readily available. And if we can do it cheap enough, but sturdy enough that these things would actually last quite a bit of time because of the way that they're running, they're not tearing themselves apart. See, what I was saying about the internal combustion engine being the equivalence of over unity a while back, you think about the math on that. You think about how hot an engine gets, and that's with the radiator. Your average internal combustion engine runs at about 180 to 220 degrees, depending on what type of vehicle you got and how hard you're running it, how much of a load you're pulling on it. But nonetheless,
dropping the hammer.
Yeah. Nonetheless, if you take that radiator off of that deal, that engine will generate enough heat from friction, vibration, and combustion portion of it to destroy itself. And so by guiding the heat where you want it, heat's your worst enemy in everything as far as electronics and mechanical. That is your worst loss. Because once you get to a certain point when the oil breaks down and friction kicks in and it starts to wear on parts, you know, it's all downhill from there. But if you build the perfect engine that will keep the heat where you want it to go, not allow the heat to transfer through to the block of the engine, and you use the same concept in the transmission, the differential, the rear end of your two-wheel drives or whatever, you could use the same exact concepts, and you could keep that machinery so cool that it will still function properly and it will never wear out. The only thing that ever wears anything out is friction.
One thing is, going back to horse bodies, how to use a wrench and so forth, as the wood chips rot, it's actually perfect for a mushroom. Now, again, I have seen personally some compost piles that were not tended properly get so hot that they would actually ignite and catch on fire and smolder underneath. That you don't want. Therefore, with your hot tub drawing heat from it, to keep it from catching on fire, or pulling a plastic pipe in your compost pile and running water to it to heat your house, and also keep it from catching on fire, you have a steady source of mushrooms, which to me is gourmet food. I love mushrooms, especially in spaghetti sauce. I mean, there's so many things you can do with nothing but just pure trash.
Yeah.
I mean, 15 acres of land around there. I mean, go out there with a rake or air blower, a leaf blower, and blow all the leaves up in one pile, cut them up into small pieces of lawnmower, packing them underneath your hot tub, you're heating your hot tub, you're heating water, not just for a hot tub, but you can actually use some of that water to heat your house, heat your shop. and at the same time, compost in the spring for your garden. I mean, it's a win-win-win-win situation all the way around. You can't beat it.
Well, essentially what you just explained right there is the fact that we could actually not only build engines that would be super efficient, but we could build a house that would be self-contained.
Yes.
Because exactly. you could control where that, even if so, for some reason, because I've actually seen hay bales that will self-combust if they get too hot.
Yep.
You could actually contain that process to where it would still have the heat, but you could regulate that heat to the point or even the oxygen for that matter to where it wouldn't ever raise above a certain temperature and you wouldn't have to worry about it combusting.
Over 50 times in my life I've seen hay bales sitting out to sea and catching on fire simply because they were packed so tight and they were a little bit green. They blow them up. And I have seen hay bales catch on fire with 6 inches of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, folks. I mean, there's a lot of heat energy there. A lot of heat energy.
Just think about it. It takes a long time for a hay bale to completely rot away. But in the process of that, you got like you could build a metal container that would hold a hay bale and just allow, you know, ventilation long enough for it to have oxygen so it could still do what it needs to do to rot and generate a lot of heat. That would be a really good project for us to do for a video. Would be to go out and get, you know, like an old galvanized cattle tank or even, you know, modify an old hot water tank to be able to fit a hay bale in and then run some tubing in and out through there. That way that while the process of the rotting is going on, that it's actually heating water that you're circulating through there and take some measurements to show. What do you think?
You'd be surprised at how many ranchers that use round bales of hay have more than they need, and after a couple of years they get moldy and they can't feed it to the cattle. They'll give you the stuff just to haul it off, get it out of their way.
Yeah, and not to mention...
They load it on your trailer for you.
When you mow your yard, you can take all the grass clippings, catch them in the bag, take all your grass clippings and use that.
Woo! You cut grass clippings while they're green and pack them up in a plastic bag. You got a lot of heat, my friend.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yep. The only thing about a compost pile, man, I had one. I put a compost pile out here. It was up to the bottom of my rib cage. And, you know, it got quite wide, up to around 8 foot diameter. And I walk out there now. If I shuffle my foot back and forth, basically it doesn't even come up to the top of my socks. I keep adding to it. And I used to bag the grass a couple of years ago, and that's how I got so much in leaves and stuff towards the fall. But compost dwindles down. You can just keep. You don't have to worry about what to do with the old compost. Just keep piling it on there. I never turn it. I don't do anything. I should turn it if I was going to, you know, try to ramp the heat up and everything. I still throw my coffee grounds out on it. But I've got so, in the meantime, I've got so much stuff growing in my compost pile. Even though it's got down to like 20 degrees, every time the weather warms up, I've got new sprouts coming back out. I mean, it might kill the stuff on top, but you know what? The roots are warm. The stuff just doesn't die out. Nothing dies out on it. I don't have to add compost to it like you do in the garden. I just keep letting stuff grow. Yes. Anything your bell pepper starts to rot out on one side, you know, cut off the good stuff, rinse it off, throw it in your crock pot. The rest of it, man, I just throw. As a matter of fact, I'm saying about a third of my produce that I get from the store or whatever, I throw into the compost pile because it doesn't get eaten fast enough. But I do have an update. I do have an update for you, not to change the subject. The last time it got down to 20 degrees Fahrenheit and 10 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, you know, 10 degrees Fahrenheit is like 20 below Celsius, or 15 below Celsius at least. And, man, that's almost good Canada weather in the winter. But this pallet palace up. Now they're sitting there saying, yeah, I'm going to find the time to move everything out. I did. pulled everything out, swept, and did all that kind of good stuff. And all that plastic wrap on the outside of pallets that hold all the stuff on, that is awesome insulation. And I stuffed at it. I had a whole wall that was uninsulated. Had two heaters running on high down here, on separate extension cords coming from the outside plugs below the meter. Well, I got one heater running on low, kind of continuous, when it got down to like 35 degrees last night. And after stuffing these walls and throwing cardboard over it and finished and sealing it and everything, I'll tell you what, it's more like an igloo cooler now.
Buddy.
So I got one heater running on low instead of two on high. One difference.
Buddy.
It has made, it's an igloo cooler in here. Yeah, go ahead.
We need your skill that first got me interested in your YouTube channel. And we need what you just talked about the compost pile. Do you think that you could build a coffee can Stirling engine again and a system by which you can use the compost to run that Stirling engine?
Oh, Lord, yes. He can do that in a heartbeat.
Oh, you mean like stick the hot cap of the Stirling engine down in the compost to run the compost, to run the water, to run it over to the radiator and put a little 12-volt fan to blow the heat in here?
Yeah.
Man, that runs through my mind. Like I said, there's so many things and you don't bring it too far. Just seems like you just can't get it to take off. But I tell you what, throwing this other insulation in here and then covering the rest of this other wall, what a difference. What a difference. I'm so, so glad. Now I know when it drops down to below freezing and everything, it's gonna be a breeze.
So you lost me here, buddy. The project. Would you be willing to do that project to see if you can make it work with the Stirling engine and the compost?
Not with a tin can Stirling engine. The kerosene heaters, they got that glass globe, or actually cylinder, around the outside of where
yeah,
it burns.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Regardless of which one you use.
That's thermal. Those things can take a lot of heat and they don't crack. They're heat tempered. And the cool thing, glass does not conduct heat. A tin can, man, you heat the bottom, the top gets hot through the conduction of the heat through the tin. Now, the tin can Stirling engine, to me, is pretty much a flop. And the fact that I didn't use a regenerative, steel wool displacer. A regenerative displacer gives you probably about 3/4 the power.
Now that you know all that, you could actually modify your old version in order to do it. And you could use, instead of a tin can to hold the portion that you're composting in, you could use a glass container and run your, maybe some coil copper tubing down inside there to bring that heat out to the engine or something.
Right. The other thing is, if you use the heat from the compost, you're pretty much cooling the inside of the pile. So that I'd be burning more of it than I would be collecting the heat from here. So I'm thinking probably just a solar panel and an electric water pump, or just let it go by convection current.
So you don't think that the compost would generate enough heat to run a Stirling engine?
That'd be a lot of compost or an extra pile, but yeah, it could actually do that. You could actually run. I think I could run winter heat with enough compost. The other problem where I am at is basically my driveway is about 45 degrees and washed out. Boomer has seen it. He understands it. Asplund is not going to factor and try to get their trucks up there to dump it. They can't get it to where I need it. It'd be a real pain in the wazoo. I used to carry up the bags of grass after mowing and stuff like that. Now, that made quite a bit of difference.
But all we're talking about is a small scale, man.
For what I need to do the project, I would actually need the truck to be able to come up here.
All we're talking about is on a small scale. Small Stirling engine, you can buy them online on eBay pretty cheap. Small Stirling engine, small compost deal, just enough to generate enough heat. Because I've seen some of these Stirling engines that will run off the temperature off of your hand.
Right, but they don't have much power.
That's not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is the fact that you can actually do it. You can work out all the bugs later and make it be able to do more. You understand what I'm trying to say here? The one that I got...
The way that I see it, me and Boom Boom have talked about this. He's got these big round steel discs. I think they're, 5 foot in diameter.
5 feet, 2 inches.
How big are they?
5 feet, 2 inches, and a quarter of an inch thick.
Right. Now, you can make a low temperature differential Stirling engine that would actually... The cool thing about the low temperature differential is that it has a big heating area and works with a surface area. So therefore it collects heat and heats the air a lot faster because the medium, which is the air, I guess, in there, is between the displacer and the plate. It's not very thick, so that means that air is going to heat up very quickly. Because of all the surface, and cool very quickly. But as far as if you throw that on a compost pile, you can probably get it to run and stay running on a compost pile. But it's cooling that because of the large surface area. It's like opening up your compost pile. Your compost pile is not hot on top; it's hot in the middle inside where it's been. Where it's been insulated from the outside.
Yeah, but you told me
you could get some good things off it.
You had told me a while back that you could run the black garden hose underneath the compost pile and generate hot water.
Yes, compost pile wouldn't have to be black.
Well, if you can generate hot water, then you can also generate enough temperature to literally run a small Stirling engine.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's what I'm telling
you. What Fowler's trying to get at to you should live is you want it to do work, and he's trying to say that it is scalable. In other words, you could build a tiny one that would actually turn, but it wouldn't do any work. But the most beautiful part about the Stirling engine is it is scalable upwards.
I've got a little small Stirling engine that has a built-in generator on it.
This has been done and works well. You go to permies.com with Paul Wheaton. You'll find that he has these students come in every year, about 12 to 15 students every year to learn permaculture. And their shower that they have up there, they've done this. They put the hose up underneath or on a bed of compost and then put more compost on top, got the coffee grounds, and them guys, because the water pressure is already there and they don't need a pump, see, that's the thing, you're not drawing energy for a pump as well. They guys can take a shower one after another, all of them, and not run out of hot water. Now that's the ticket.
Well,
with the compost, you can heat that water up and just constantly take one shower after another and never run out of hot water.
So if you're doing it on that scale, then you could do it on a smaller scale, is what I'm saying. I got a little Stirling engine.
The same size as mine.
I got a little Stirling engine that has its own built-in generator, and it runs off a little alcohol burner. And... Right. So, with that said, if you could generate enough heat for that little Stirling engine like that, and then be able to basically it has little LED lights on it. The Stirling engine turns and turns the generator, which turns the lights on. If the temperature of that compost can get hot enough to heat up water, then it has more than enough temperature to maintain that Stirling engine, which would light up the lights, which in my view, that's getting work done.
You know, the thing is, you got to get it that the average heat produced by a compost pile, the average heat is over 140 degrees.
Well, that's more than enough to do what needs to be done.
Now, here's the next thing you're forgetting, all right? Hot water rises. So if your compost is built wide and tall, you could spiral your pipe in your compost pile, or as it heated, it would rise. Then when it came out, you would insulate it, run it over to your house. When it threw the Stirling engine, the hot water would run the Stirling engine. Then the water would come out of the Stirling engine, would go into the radiator, and the Stirling engine would run the fan to blow more heat off the hot water and heat your house. And of course, as it cooled, it would run downhill and run right back to your type of big compost pile. No electricity used whatsoever. And you're
still on the way,
and you're drawing the heat off the compost pile to heat your house.
Right. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yes.
Well, and if you also threw in a solar water heater with that same system, you had the compost pile thing inside of like a metal container that had copper tubing up underneath it, would run the water through your solar portion of it. And then from that point on into your Stirling engine and into your house, then you wouldn't be losing no heat underneath the compost pile. It'd be supplemented by the solar heater.
Right.
So
do we have one of those sock drawer gnome plans here? You know, steel socks. Step one, step two, question mark, question mark, question mark. Step three, profit.
And you lost me.
I'm not seeing an outline for any steps or anything like that for Shaz's original purpose that he brought all this stuff up, which is the plan.
Well, the
plan.
I laid out the plan, and then I was asking Muddy if he would be willing to work on a project, to do a small project, to throw a video up there that had to do with the Stirling engine and the compost, because that came under the efficiency portion.
Right.
But I don't think he believes it should be done, so...
Is that system to pull the heat off of the engine instead of the compost pile? You're using the engine to produce the heat. You could then turn that into additional power.
Well, yeah.
I got you.
What I'm getting at, Shaziz, is thermal to mechanical is actually pretty small. Yeah, I could pump water, but it wouldn't be enough to, like, pump a shower and heat. I'd have to have a lot of compost.
But
separate
we don't.
Piles. Yes, we could.
But
yes, we could.
But we don't want that for a tiny project. I'm just saying, that little Stirling engine that I got off of eBay, it has the glass tube like you were talking about. Now, if that glass tube was underneath rotting compost, then it should generate enough heat to actually get the mechanical motion to turn that little generator head and light up the lights. As far as I'm concerned, that's all that needs to be done to prove the concept.
Oh, yeah, we can make the compost light up lighting.
Well, there you go.
Probably not enough to run an electric motor and then pump water as well, but I mean, that's a lot higher energy. But, yeah, a light would be pretty easy to knock up, especially LED light.
You know how much trash the average household generates on a daily basis?
Yeah.
A lot.
Actually, heard it said 1.5 kilowatt per hour was an estimate back about 8 years ago, but the average house is actually using over 2K an hour.
So what I'm saying is that you could design a system that the average Joe could put their trash in, you know, minus the metal and the, you know, plastic or something like that, use those for different purposes, but you could build a system that would take that trash and turn it into usable energy, whether it be for lighting or whatever.
Right.
But these small-scale projects... Listen.
The average Joe doesn't generate enough stuff to throw out every day to keep something like that running.
You were talking about throwing your compost on the... You're talking about throwing your coffee grounds onto your compost pile. All right, well, how much food waste has an average household got? And that's not something that has to be thrown on there every single day, you know. But if you got it, you throw it on there. You mow your grass, you throw it on there. Whatever. You see what I'm saying? So, using the trash, there's tons of different ways that you can use the trash in order to, even the plastic for that matter. That plastic could literally be refined into burnable fuel without, you know, all the waste. You see what I mean?
Here, let's bring into perspective what I'm talking about. If you got a compost pile or you got a bunch of branches that clipped off your tree, now you decide when there's no burn ban to go ahead and burn that. You get a lot of energy, and it's only going to last a few hours. A lot of energy, just like one of them Stirling engines, the Ryder Erickson Stirling engines that they use to pump water. They split a log, they throw it up onto the Stirling engine. And it pumps water for a few hours to irrigate the field. But then it's gone. All of that has to be replaced. Compost it takes a while to compost down. It's not putting out the wattage like it would be if you put a fire by far. It takes almost the whole year to knock the whole thing down. So it's a slow energy output. I mean, there is energy there. We could do it in the lawn clippings and all of that stuff. But the thing is, I'd have to have a lot of compost to run energy enough to use anything above, you know, just running LED light or something for a night light and things like that.
Well, I'm just saying, it's
very efficient.
There's a guy in Holland that heats his house with compost every year. He builds a 15 to 20 foot diameter, 6 to 7 foot high compost pile. Heats his entire house.
That's what I'm talking about. Massive compost.
We're the
not the average Joe throwing his vegetables out every day.
The thing is, compost, on spring, you've got a natural fertilizer for the garden to grow more vegetables. So the thing, what Buddy was trying to say is, there's only so much energy in a piece of wood.
I understand, but what you guys are missing is the piece of the puzzle. Each one of these
is exactly what Scotty was talking about. The piece of the puzzle is how do you want to use that energy. You can use it very slow, very efficient, and then use what's left over. Or you can use it very fast and wasteful.
On the positive note,
like Boone said, if you want to have a 15, 20 foot diameter, 7 foot high compost, now that's going to put out a lot of heat for a long time.
Yeah. Yes.
That would be. The average Joe.
Something is somebody else that I've been talking to from a completely different group was talking about, where they were talking about using electrolysis off of like the power generated from the engine to generate some HHO and pump it in there with it, try to assist the gas. The one point he made is that may actually raise the efficiency rating to make sure all the fuel that's being pumped in there is burning. You're not getting any waste coming out of the exhaust that's unburnt fuel.
Yeah.
Even though you're not actually getting more energy out of the HHO than you're putting into it in order to create it, you are getting, if he's right, you are getting another like 60 to 80% more energy out of the fuel that you're putting in there that you normally don't get. It's there, it's just being thrown away.
Exactly.
And that was the point that I was trying to get with the Stirling engine deal, was that, all these are just pieces of the puzzle. It's why people supplement their solar with wind and so on, because, you know, you got limitations, how much energy you can actually produce. But the little project that I was talking to Muddy about was just to prove the basic concept that you could actually get enough heat to even turn the Stirling engine.
Oh, yes.
If you can heat the water, then you can turn the Stirling engine. Well, take that Stirling engine concept, match it up with this this engine that I'm talking about with the plan that I was saying. There's a heat exchanger coming off from that exhaust that you can run in to create yet even more mechanical energy. You see what I'm saying? This is what Muddy was talking about. This that's just one piece of the puzzle. We understand the limitations of each one of these by themselves. But combined in conjunction with one another, there's no limitation.
The thing is, it's scalable.
Sure it is.
The smaller you make it, the less efficient it's going to be. And the compost pile, the bigger you make it, the more efficient it's going to be.
Yeah, but for video purposes and simplicity is the only reason why I suggested he make a model like he did the old deal. If he doesn't want to do that, that's fine. I mean, you know, it was just an idea that I threw on the table.
You make a compost pile the size of a 5-gallon bucket, you're not going to get any energy out of it at all. The heat is going to leach through the sides. But if you build it bigger around and insulate the sides and the bottom, then you're going to get a lot of energy, a heck of a lot more than you think. You a 10-foot diameter compost pile, 4 or 5 feet high, you insulate the bottom and the sides with styrofoam or some kind of insulation to it, the heat cannot leach out. The heat coming off that thing is going to be unbelievable.
So would there be no heat in an insulated coffee can full of rotting compost?
No heat, but no word in there, not enough to do what you're talking about.
To run a Stirling engine, you can run Stirling engines off the temperature on your hand.
It's not going to generate as much as you. You're going to find out you stick your hand in the middle of that coffee can of compost, and it's not even warm.
It's scalable.
You've got to have a big size before you start seeing anything.
Exactly. It's scalable.
It's all that compost on the outside that is the insulator, and the concentration of heat the farther in you go.
I don't know a homeowner that lives on a piece of land that they're buying and put their home on it that doesn't have a quarter of their yard that they couldn't build an 8-foot by 8-foot compost pile. That 8-foot by 8-foot compost pile would be more than enough to heat a small shop or a kitchen or a bedroom or something like that at night. Far more than enough heat.
All right. Well, I think we wasted enough time on the dead end project. I'm going to try it, but
not a dead end project unless you build it too small. It is an actually fantastic project.
The chemical reaction is going to be the same no matter what size it is. If you got rotten grass, we're mincing words here. If you got rotting grass, and even if it's on a small scale, it's still going to be producing heat. And so I'm not trying to run my house off of a coffee can. That's not what I'm trying to get at. I'm just trying to say that you can actually get something done, even on a small scale. And if it was able to be done on a small scale, obviously you can scale it up to a large scale. And so with this, making this engine as super as efficient as possible, and all the heat losses generated from internal combustion engine, I don't want to overlook any anomaly. I want to use all of them that it can be possibly used, such as the process of, you know, expansion and contraction of air pressure because of the heat transfer that you got going on. So with everything from Stirling engines to Peltier elements to piezoelectrics to catch the vibration of the engine block itself, everything on that engine, there is no loss. it's all being guided where you want it to go. That was a whole purpose of me even bringing up the Stirling engine and trying to make a miniature small scale model. I've seen people put in their hand a small Stirling engine that will run off the temperature of their hand. That's sitting out in the open, but it's on your hand. Granted, I know that your body is generating more temperature than, you know, that rotting compost. But if that rotting compost, even on a small scale, could generate any form of BTUs, BTUs can actually be transferred into some sort of usable energy, even if it's only running a Peltier element to get a temperature difference from the bottom of the can to the bottom of the compost, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you could actually make a low temperature differential Stirling engine of a decent size, set the bottom of it in water, and paint the top of it black and let the sun hit it, and then you're going to get more than we were talking about a minute ago.
Well, that's even another plus.
Even in
the process of disputing what's worthy and what ain't worthy, we still come across other things that are worthy, because you can get thermal from the sun to literally, you know, you could paint the car black and have the inside of the car frame itself surrounded with tubing that would transfer that heat from the black paint down through the metal into the doggone tube and heat up whatever's inside there. So there's so many different ways by which you can use just what nature's provided alone, you know, to generate power. You can have a thermal car that would sit there and charge your battery while it's sitting out in the sun. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
That's a fact. My daddy bought a black Cadillac off a wino one night there for $45, you know, when I was a kid. And that's over, you know, that's around 50 years ago or so. I remember going, getting out in my Sunday go to meeting clothes and go out to the car, and if you didn't grab the chrome handle, open the door, and you put your hand on the black car, you would burn your hand.
Yes.
Especially since the shine was all gone and it was a flat black, man, it would collect the heat from the sun like you wouldn't believe.
Well,
and I remember several times getting blisters on my hand from that Cadillac.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I remember
my
sitting in the back of the...
I didn't have calluses then, but I remember burning my hand.
I remember sitting in the back of a pickup truck on a tire with my shorts on and getting my biscuits burnt.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's energy. Well, that's good energy.
That's what I've been trying to say all along. All these different anomalies, doesn't matter. The rubber, for some reason, because it's black, will hold a lot of heat for a long time. It was dark outside when I sat on that tire, but that tire had been out in the sun all day long. And that tire was still hot.
I've got one of those Leyland thermometers, and I went out about 2 or 3 years ago in a wet time, and I started shooting different things, and the total thing I shot was like 22 degrees Fahrenheit. And I shot the black tires on my car, 143 degrees.
Well, there you go, man.
They weren't behind glass or anything. So you're right. Rubber or empty plastic that's flat black, it's unbelievable how much heat it will drop.
I'll tell you what. I got my laser thermometer. I went up to the roof of my house in the summertime. And I got 243 degrees off the roof of my house, and it wasn't black, it was that red. I got tin roof.
You know, this once before, what about taking tires on rim and fill them full of water, put two valve stems on them so that you can, you know, put them in series or parallel and put them behind glass in the sunlight? That would be unbelievable amount of hot water.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. I mean, from 22 degrees to 143, there's no protection from the wind. How hot would it get if it was behind glass?
And how?
An insulating layer of glass with a little air, exactly.
And how hard would it be to actually take some old tires and get them up to temperature, just melting temperature, not where they're going to burn, but just get them up to melting temperature and allow that melted rubber to run down over some copper tubing and literally make mats that are interconnectable that you can lay out somewhere in your yard and generate heat during this winter or the summer.
Now that is a kick butt idea. Because you can melt fire without catching on fire.
Well, if you could do that, then you'd solve a big problem out there in the automotive industry, because they got tons and tons of fields full of tires that people would give you just to get rid of them.
Yes.
Not to mention, once you melt it off the tire, there's some pretty good grade steel inside there where they use the steel for the belts, the steel belted radials, that you could recycle that doggone steel.
That's some really high grade steel too.
Yeah. So there's a process right there that somebody could actually literally go out there and start a home business or an industry for that matter, by going around recycling old tires and melting the old tires down into mats that are inserted with copper tubing or stainless or even aluminum for that matter, because it's not going to melt the aluminum. It's not going to get that hot. If it does, it's going to catch on fire. But, you know, even that, aluminum or as far as that goes, you know, some sort of higher temperature rubber hose that you could send through there. And you can literally build mats that you can lay outside to, you know, circulate water through your hot water heater. It might say a welcome, have a welcome sign on there. It says welcome, but just don't step on this mat barefoot.
You know, I got that 12 foot by 4 foot solar hot water heater that Jim decided I needed more than he needed to run it to scrap. Somebody else tried to scrap it before I could get it to my house, but it had a layer of foam on the back. Part of that got ripped, and a piece of it missing. But I got more foam. I can sit there and stuff with inside that thing. It's got these wide sections. The whole inside is painted black, and it's got glass on the front to keep the heat from being dissipated, like as if it would not be out in the open. Remember me burning my hand on that black Cadillac? The feel is the water goes through these the areas that receive the heat from the sun are wide, very wide, and it goes back and forth, zigzagging back and forth or meandering back and forth, to pretty much cover a good 60 or 70%, plus where it doesn't hit those, it hits a black background that radiates the heat back up to them. In the meantime, it keeps the temperature inside very hot. But the two plates in between where the water runs is only like about a quarter inch thick or less. So when it hit the sun, hits it, it heats that water fast. Because kind of like the low temperature differential, I said it's surface area that collects the heat and transfers it to the water. And if you don't have much water there to heat, it heats up quick. Now, I'll tell you what, if I run that to a shower out here, I could have the sun beating on it. By the time you soak back up, that water would probably get back up to temperature enough where you definitely have to have some cold water to add to it. It's the deal of how much you're trying to heat with how much surface area. It's the ratio or proportion.
There you go. How hard would it be to build a big steel pot that would melt tires, and what would be the melting temperature of an average car tire?
That I'm not sure of. I know of a guy who used bleach to help soften it down. He was going to sit there, and as the bleach evaporated back off and everything, it would re-solidify, and he was going to start recapping tires by mold instead of throwing the glue and then baking it and getting it going, recapping that way. And he had furnaces that would actually heat to help heat it and help melt it, so you didn't have to use as much bleach. The bleach is pretty harmful to the ozone layer.
Well, my hopes is not to have to put any additives into it.
Yeah, that'd be much, much greener. I don't know the temperature. I know them roads out in El Paso get hot. If you try to run across them, that tire sticks to your feet, you got a total blister up your feet. At that point, people actually do start losing a little bit of rubber off your tires. So I don't think it's going to have to be all that high. Probably 300-400 degrees. Maybe it's quite a bit higher than that. At least I know you're getting closer to the ballpark.
Well, if
we need to, we need to look at basically the steps we're gonna go through to get the lab set up and the people together to work on this too. Like, I mean, are we gonna outfit several different labs in different locations and use the U.S. mail and convening together with a truckload of stuff from one group to the next? What are we going to do?
Well, my thing is everybody who's got the best skill set would be doing it where they had the best tools to do it. If we weren't able to move everybody into a centralized lab, that would be the best way to go from that point. But the best case scenario is we actually got essentially the geek group has got going on. They got a building that they work out of, and they bring all their people to that building and make all kinds of stuff.
Right, now, right.
That would be the best go. And I got plenty of land. We could throw a doggone Morton building up on this property and build that kind of deal. It wouldn't cost nobody for the land or nothing. We just have to figure out, whether using recycled materials and build it ourselves physically or what,
I think the cost is kind of negligible if we just put as much thought and put our heads together the way as we've been doing over what we've been just discussing today alone, and then put some elbow grease into whatever it is we're doing.
Well, I'm all ready for it, man. Look, I got the plan right there. I know for a fact that we could build the perfect generator, the most super efficient combustion engine in the history of time, the best generator, and we could use off the shelf things that we could actually go down to our local scrapyard to gather up parts for. So, cost wise, what I'm talking about ain't that big of a deal. And
I think one thing we've got that we're not taking into account too is there are two types of people that are interested in us. There are those that just want something that works, and most of them aren't actually doing any development. And then there are those who they want to do something, and they've got some idea already. They've got some goal that they're already on, so it's kind of hard to pull them off their goal and put them on somebody else's goals. So that's why I said the best of two worlds would be if we had a place where everybody could get together, or we had the resources to help people get up and running where they're at and bring the stuff together once it's done, so you're not having to bring a whole lab of tools there, and you don't have to set up, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you make it so that basically everybody can assist everybody else in their ideas, because they're the ones that are doing the actual...
That's what I was getting ready to say. What if our research would help them get to their goal faster?
Well, what if your research has nothing to do with what they're doing, but the tools that you're working with could help them?
Well, same thing. Help them out.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So, you've got to be able to have a way to basically scratch each other's back, because it doesn't matter who wins this race. Everybody gets the prize.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole plan. That's the plan in a nutshell. I'm not a good manufacturer. I can't make things quality. But you got.
I got a question for you. Who manufactured that Electron, or whatever you call it, that motorcycle that's all electric?
I did, and it was all made out of junk, just to prove a point.
What you used to make it? What skills and techniques? Because it's holding up and running pretty well.
I used a 110 wire welder and a bunch of recycled junk, just to prove a point.
Okay, so you're good at welding.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say good. I mean, it's kind of spotty, but it had...
Consider yourself to be your skill level to be on all this other stuff you're complaining about not being good enough at. The wire welds have better than flying apart.
The wire weld probably get better if I get a hold of me one of those doggone auto-dimming helmets, because the problem that I had with welding was that you get your lined up on your wire weld and you put your mask down.
Raymond, hear that? Raymond, you hear that?
Yes, I did, and he's got one just coming to him.
He's already got a welder there, too.
Cool.
I know, I think it's one.
Yeah, exactly. In a box still. I'll bet you it's still in the box.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how much better my weld will be with a doggone auto-dimming helmet.
You know, the thing is, that the machine that I gave you is not a wire welder. It's a TIG welder, a stick welder, and a plasma torch, and it's 220 volts.
Yeah, between that welder and the one I got, there ain't nothing I couldn't manufacture with metal.
That plasma torch will cut through 3/4 inch solid steel like a hot knife through butter.
There you go.
As clean as you would cut it with a hacksaw.
Well, actually, your hand is steady, it'll be cleaner.
Yeah.
Well, my hand's steady. It's just, like I said, whenever you put your wire where you want it and then you put the shield down, by the time you put the shield down, you've already moved a fraction of an inch far enough that when you hit that trigger, you're on the wrong spot.
I've got 6 or 8 of those shields like you're talking about. One's got your name on it.
Cool. Well, that'll save a lot of hassle.
Put enough LED light together that whenever your hood's down, you can actually see what you're welding without the auto dimming system.
I don't know.
I'm saying they get pretty bright. Those 100 watt ones, they put out enough light that without any kind of protection over your eyes, it'll blind you.
You do not want that.
You
want the weld from the light of the weld itself. Nothing else. Anything else is just too much light, and you will actually get UV rays through the glass.
Hmm. Well, that's the thing, though. The LEDs aren't putting any UV out.
No, but the weld is.
Yeah, the weld is, yeah.
Right, but how would that assist the you can't get photons to assist photons. That's one kind of problem you've got, is that they tend to actually interact with each other and counteract each other.
Because if it's an auto-dim helmet, unless you're talking about a standard helmet, if it's...
Back up. I'm not talking about an auto-dim. I'm talking about just a standard, it's always as dark as it's going to be. So you got this light that you put the hood down, you turn the light on. You got to put the hood down first, because if you turn the light on first, it'll be as bright as hitting the arc without having the hood down. But it's bathing a soft light bright over the entire area, so that you've got this intense light where the weld's at, but you can see everything else around the weld, too, while you're doing it.
Well, that's a possibility.
I don't know. It sounds like light will work, but at the same time, my eyesight is way too important for me to even take a chance on something like that.
Right.
Helmet is the best way to go. Those things, the ones I've got, they go from light green to solid dark, like the darkest you want, and the darkest is settable. You can set it anywhere from 6 to 13, and 13 being the darkest, 6 being the lightest. The 6 is what you want for a cutting, and you can set it where it will stay at 6. Therefore, you can use it to grind with, or you can use it to cut with a torch. 8 or 9 is where you want it for plasma cutting. 12 to 13 is where you want it for actual welding, stick welding. But it's got a deal on it where you set it where it will not get dark. It stays at number 6. Grinding metal, the sparks are bright enough it will cause it to go dark. That's why you got a setting that locks at 6 when you see grinding it.
Cool.
Well, if you're really getting after grinding something, you can blind yourself with that light too, so you don't have protection. So that 6 is a good intermediary for that.
Exactly.
All right, so sounds...
put together a CNC machine that does welding, too, to 3D print things out of metal, man.
Yeah.
We're getting left behind. There's like two groups now doing that. One has a mill going around behind it, each line that it lays down and cleans it up. So when you get done, it's already got the post-processing done.
I would love to put one up, my wire welder up to a CNC machine, see how well we can print something out of metal.
Right.
That would be good.
Would it be possible to use that too for welding parts together too?
Yes, you could.
So.
All right, well, sounds like we got some things in the works then. So for everybody out there listening to what we've been talking about today, if you jump over there to shazizradio.com/the, looks like a negative sign, plan.html, then you can see whether or not you'd be interested in what it is we're talking about. Basically, one of the suggestions that I'm making is that we actually build the most super efficient internal combustion engine where there is absolutely no losses in the system. Everything's guided to where you want it to go. You use the waste energy that would be created from the combustion of an internal combustion engine, the vibration of it, and everything. Everything that generates heat on an internal combustion engine. Somebody needs to do the math sometime and see how many BTUs is actually generated from running one gasoline or diesel engine, and actually do the math to see if whether or not it even comes close to over unity. Because as far as I'm concerned, if that thing has the power to tear itself apart, then it's over unity. That's as simple as that. Those folks out there are going to disagree with me, but regardless, that's a lot of energy to be wasted. If you're going to be running this engine anyway, you might as well be running it on less fuel, which will make it more efficient. You might as well be focusing the heat where you want it, which will be more efficient. You might as well be taking off the exhaust off of this thing and using that heat for another purpose, which will be more efficient. There's so many different possibilities, so many potentials that could come out of just building this one engine. You know,
to answer your question that you asked a minute ago, 1 gallon of gasoline contains 360 BTUs. The best automobile engine on the road only uses 30% of that. The rest of it goes out the tailpipe. 30% of that is 108 BTUs. So, actually, you could build an engine, if you could build it efficient enough, that would run a little bit over 3 to 3.5 times the volume of 10 gallons of gasoline and produce that much more energy.
Well, ain't that what we want?
Yeah.
Save people money.
Yeah.
To give them the option to live a better life. You know?
That's why a paper carburetor runs so much better, you get so much more gas mileage. Because you're not burning a liquid gasoline, you're burning fuel only.
Well, I believe that we can take it a step further and run this off of straight water. No additives whatsoever, just straight water.
Well, I believe that myself.
And, you know, Stan Myers in 1979 was running around in a dune buggy, running off of water, tried to tell everybody about it. He tried to get rich and, you know, they did what they did. You know, there's a conspiracy in there for you to think about. why it is that mainstream military-industrial complexes or energy providers or whatever, why they would want that information to not be on the market. There's a good reason. I mean, it's all financial. But what I'm talking about is bringing the average Joe together. The shade tree mechanics, the backyard scientists, the garage scientists, the brilliant minds from around the world, people that by themselves have a specific skill set and can basically complement those other talents and skills out there that everybody else has got. By myself, I'm just one guy with a lot of good ideas. But with everybody else, we formulate what I call the dream team. There ain't nothing we can't accomplish if we don't really set our mind to it, you know?
I believe that.
So that's what I'm trying to say to everybody. That's what I'm trying to give the world what the world said that they needed. They said that there was a need for clean, renewable, alternative green energy. I'm trying to keep my word to the power company to share this information with each and every individual out there for free. So I put together Shaziz YouTube. I put together ShazizRadio.com. And I'm still working on more internet-related, you know, connected out there to Facebook, to Twitter, to YouTube, to Google+, whatever you think of those platforms. There's still ways to get information out to each and every one of you to try to help you out. All the ideas that Muddy's came up with, and Raymond, and Thomas, and everybody else who's been on this show prior, all these little anomalies, don't look at each one of these anomalies by themselves. Take all these pieces of the puzzle, put them together, find ways to make your homes and your machines run more efficiently, save yourself some money, then reinvest that money into helping somebody else in this world do the same. There ain't no reason why anybody in this planet should be starving or cold or homeless, because we got everything we need to literally come together and provide for each and every person out here on this planet. I don't call it Shaziz Mad Science for nothing. I call it Mad Science because it really frustrates me and makes me angry that here we are in the year 2017 and trying to keep people motivated to moving forward towards a project when I know the true power lies in the individual out there and your skills and your talents. Heck, if you ain't a mechanic or an electrical engineer or any science whatsoever, you might be a cook, and we're going to get hungry working on this stuff. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's a great contribution.
You think you can't have something to add? We might need some entertainment, so start singing over there if you can hold a tune. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is what this is all about.
Sing if you can't go pull the tune.
Yeah, otherwise we'll find some of our talented and skilled peoples to give you a wedgie or something. See, we're even going to need the tough guy to protect us from the bad guys as they try to steal our ideas.
There you go.
Everybody has something to add to this deal. Folks, I know we can do it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be wasting my life trying to prove it. And if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough. We've explained to you ad nauseum hundreds, if not thousands, of different ways and methods and combinations of ways to produce energy that nature's already provided for you. There's storage capacities. It's just unlimited. And if you take some of these people out there that a lot of people go around and badmouth all the time because they think, well, you know, that ain't free energy, that ain't got nothing. And then you turn around and you step back and you look at that piece of the puzzle with this piece of the puzzle, and then you start to see the whole big picture. The big picture is this. Those folks out there who want to stay wealthy, they're going to keep you divided, and you ain't going to bring your part together with the other part. You ain't going to have the 9 billion people on the planet coming together to fix this planet. You're going to have a money-making machine, because people are still going to be sick. They're still going to be cold. They're still going to be hungry. And they're still going to be homeless. I'm telling you that the power is in the average Joe out there, and if you ever choose to come together, you will become the largest force in the history of time of average Joes, we the people, that will get the solutions done that you all been saying needed to be done. Don't tell me there's a need for clean, renewable, green energy and then laugh in my face when I tell you and point it out where it's at. Look, it's there. It's right in front of your face. It's been there all along. All you got to do is take those pieces of the puzzle that's on the table, slide them together, and there you go. You got everything you wanted. You got your, you combated the global warming slash climate change slash climate disruption or whatever it's going to be next week when the math don't add up. You have bought yourself clean, renewable, alternative energy. You solved the so-called energy crisis. And most of all, like my friend over there at Zero Fossil Fuel says, you end blood for oil. Ain't no need killing each other over oil whenever you got everything else under control.
That's right.
Now,
we need to get away from oil anyway.
That's the point, man. That's the point.
We don't need to get away from oil. We need to get away from wasting it. I mean, actually, there are so many things that come from oil that we need. Like medicines, for example. There's over 350 different very vital types of medicines that come from crude oil.
Sure. We could still use oil and use it so efficiently, there wouldn't be no waste. There wouldn't be no pollution. But my point...
You know that if you get in your car... And you burn this gasoline, 5% of the combustible energy actually makes it to your rear wheels. 5%. And then you got an alternator that's 5%.
Well,
oh my goodness, what a waste of energy.
To make the folks that are against using any fossil fuels, which is a misnomer, but regardless, to make them happy, we could go to water. For any of the environmentalists that are worried about CO2 getting out into the atmosphere, then we could go to water. For all the other people out there who want economy and efficiency, we could make them all happy by taking everything that we've learned in basic science and putting the pieces of the puzzle together in the most super efficient engine ever designed in the history of time. And I'm telling you right here and right now, I'm not a rocket scientist, but if I had the right crew, I'd get it done. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's reality. So, with that said, we're down to it, and actually kind of hair over. You guys got anything last to mention in there? Anything we forgot?
He's a rocket scientist when you got a coffee maker that makes a hot tub hot.
Yeah.
All right, Bob.
And I could make it even better if I insulate it like you guys suggested.
Yeah.
So, there we go, folks.
Smartest thing in the entire world is a furnace. No electronic parts, no food parts. You put stuff hot in it and it keeps it hot. Put stuff cold in it and it keeps it cold. It's got to be the smartest thing on the face of the earth. It's so simple.
Yep. And with that technology that we learned from the furnace, or from the thermos, we can make our furnaces better, we can make our houses better, we can make our, that was pretty cool.
Houses.
Yeah, we can make our internal combustion engines better. I don't know what more to say than hasn't already been said. If you want free energy, come to the table and let's get it done. It's as simple as that. That's all I'm asking.
Swimming in a sea for energy. Every day, every night, every second of every day. You're swimming.
My last minute.
We're not going to
last.
Go ahead.
My last minute 2 cents would just have to be this. I've got these walls thermally sealed now, and I've got all, there's no airflow. It's made one heck of a difference. I am very impressed. I will be making a YouTube video. Number two, when I saw your design, you got me thinking. And I'm thinking with a water jacket and the heat exchanger on the exhaust, that simplicity is genius. Genius is simplicity. I'm thinking, and rather than getting 5% to mechanical out of your combustion, that heat generated can be used. And I think that is, to me, that is sheer genius. It's simplicity, but it's sheer genius. It got me thinking.
Well, above that picture on that page of the plan, it says any idea can be made better with the right team. And you just explained one way you can make that thing better. I know that Thomas knows about material. He can make it better. Raymond's knows about mechanical and leverage. We could actually build the doggone camshaft to have the best amount of torque and so on and so forth. Milling, everything that we need to do it. We can build this motor. And I believe it. Bring the rest of the crew to the table and we'll have food, song and dance and, you know, a good time while we get something on the table that, that everybody out there in this world could benefit from. And you can imagine if we could do this.
It doesn't matter, we'll have so much song and dance that everybody will be distracted and nothing will get done.
Man, it's got to be a negative Nancy in every crowd.
The negativity out of it, man.
We're going to have a negative Nancy motivator to come around and anybody who says, oh, I can't do that because or whatever, you know.
Then remove the because.
Yeah. Take the because out of the equation.
Then remove the because. It's just that simple.
There you go. This is what I'm talking about. I believe it. And if you believe it, share this podcast. Share the page. Share the links. Thank you for Stephen in the chat room and everybody else posting information and sharing information. You've been listening to Mad Science. Thank you, Thomas, Muddy, and Raymond. And peace and love to everybody. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.